Welcome to the ThinkSpace podcast with myself, John Stoskowski, and Danny Massaro. Our goal with this podcast is a simple one. We discuss and dissect a prescient topic, issue, or theme that we think is interesting and might help us humans better understand why we think, feel, and do what we do. If you'd like to engage in these types of conversations too, you can check out thinkspace.academy for a unique cohort-based course that will help you think critically and live authentically. Hope you enjoy the episode. Right, Danny, the will to power. Another bit of a delve into our friend Friedrich Nietzsche. One of his central concepts, really, of his whole philosophy that runs through a lot of his work. And it's quite difficult to define initially because Nietzsche himself never really gave it an explicit definition. So even though it's something that appears through lots of his works, it's often misunderstood and misinterpreted. So even us today, we might misinterpret some elements that Nietzsche himself probably meant. But that's kind of the point of the podcast, isn't it? We're just going to try and make it a little bit practical and see how we might apply it. So the will to power is essentially what Nietzsche saw or believed to be one of the main driving forces in human beings. So we have mentioned a few different wills in different episodes, haven't we, Danny? So Schopenhauer's quite a famous one, the will to live. So the will to just avoid death and procreate. You've got Freud, who we've mentioned, I think in the previous episode, the will to pleasure. So that's the main thing that drives people's behaviors. Frankl, we talked about when we did the Man's Search for Meaning episodes. So Frankl, he thought the main drive was the will to meaning. And then you've got Nietzsche, and there are others, but Nietzsche's kicking in with the will to power. Really what it boils down to is it's a desire to impose one's will on the world. So for us to realize our utmost desires. So it involves things like self-discipline. Nietzsche calls it self-overcoming. He refers to that quite a bit in his work. Reaching your potential, self-determination, self-expression. And really at its core, it's becoming who you truly are. So that's what Nietzsche thought was a primary, almost instinctual, it's just in us drive as human beings, part of our nature, this will to power. So it's not power in terms of I want to become prime minister or I want to become king, which I think people often misinterpret it as. It's not that. It's very much this will for you to kind of realize your potential and become who you can truly become or who you can truly be. So Danny, one thing I asked you yesterday, yes, when we were texting, was do you think your will to power is stronger than your will to survive? We had a bit of a back and forth on that. So I don't know if that's a nice way to ease us in. So if you've got Schopenhauer going, no, the main will is the will to live, the will to just survive, pass on your genes, procreate, and it's brutal and that's what life's about. Whereas Nietzsche's going, no, your will to power is the primary one. It's that supersedes that. And I asked you whether it did for you.
Yeah, I think the first thing that you always think with power, you tend to think of it as true power, don't you? Like a king has power.
Yeah.
Queen, you know, she can decide to chop your head off if you've done what she wants. You know, she can do anything. She's got the power. But I think what he was talking, where I take it after originally thinking about that and then listening to loads of people explain it, it's more about the will for things to go the way you want them to go for you. It's more of, I just want this thing now. Using all my sort of faculties and sneaky ways and, you know, controlling ways or whatever, tactics, let's call them, to make this next moment go the way that it suits me. You know, I want life to work out well. If I want to stay quiet all day in my house, you know, no one interfere with me, I'm not picking up that phone. I'm not going to answer the door because I want to stay quiet today and be with myself. Whereas if you actually have a phone call coming in that's really appealing to you and you want to hear some news and you need to know, you know, like to get your, I don't know, your gas fixed or something like that, you're going to pick up that phone because ultimately you want your gas fixed, you know. So the will to power really is this energy to want things to go the way you want it to go. So when you said survive versus that, you know, you hear people say things like, I'd rather die before I admit I'm a Tory or something. I'd rather die than go to an Everton game or something. I'd rather die. You know, I know that's a joke. But some people, when they're obviously, when you're older as well and life's tough and you might be sort of on your way out, you can still be quite stubborn about how you want to die. You can still be quite stubborn about little things that matter to you. You know, I want my funeral to be like this, and I want this to be like this, and I don't want my money to go to you, and I want this, you know, and I send my, you know, so you write a will, and that's what you want to happen. So I think earlier in life, you know, when animals and people are born, I think there's a more of a natural biological will to survive. To sort of grow. But then maybe later on in life, in later stages of life, maybe for all organisms, and you'd have to look at it, but then maybe the will to survive diminishes, but there's still this kind of will to power. Like you'll see, you know, you might see all watch nature programs with lions and things like that. At the end, they might just be like, I just literally, like, I know, you know, I'm calming down now, I just want to lie here, eat, and that'll do. But when they're growing up, they're a lot more about, you know, being more dominant and vicious and attacking, and because they need to like survive and procreate for their family and so on. So that instinct, that inner drive, I think that it changes around. So when you say the will to survive versus the will to power.
I think it's a nice contrast with animals, because like when you're talking about animals there, and I noticed even in Nietzsche's work, so early on in his different writings, when he first starts talking about will to power, mm-hmm. he very much sees it as like an irrational force that's just within us, and quite a dark force as well. It's not like all, it's like a proper inner drive that's quite irrational. And in his initial writing, I was looking, a lot of that it links to things like drunken frenzy and sexual abandon and festivals of cruelty and stuff like this. Where it has a real dark connotation, which he does change later on, but it's still seen as very much a deep-rooted, the phrase I like, he called it pre-rational.
Yes.
It comes before any thought of rational, in a way, what you're doing or what you might do today and what I'm going to choose to do. It supersedes that. But it, and that unconscious force that's there, it can be harnessed towards positive stuff. So it might be used for like creative ends. And I think this is maybe where we differ. I get the impression you see it as more like in the moment, like a micro thing. So you're always saying, right, well, am I going to pick up the phone today?
Yes.
I very much kind of come at it as more macro, where it's like your life's work almost. So it's like he uses the example of, say, an artist. He'll channel this will to power to being creative. So it becomes a will to create and produce artworks, whereas a businessman, it might be, well, it becomes a will to become rich,
yes,
and make money, and so it's more like a, you know, like a higher level, what's my life journey kind of thing. You're right, that then obviously does, you could probably just chop that up into a million bits, couldn't it?
Yeah,
help you then work towards that macro level.
Yeah, I think that's what happens. You do have the vision, don't you? The mind made vision of the story of my life and where I will be, and you might want, you know, ultimate power and conquer and have money, but all the things you generally want are usually so that you can get the small things, such as, so when I wake up in the morning, someone will bring me a coffee and I won't have to be doing my garden anymore or clean the house, and I'll be able to get in business class, and I won't have to, and someone will drive me to the airport, and I'll go into a 5-star hotel where they'll look after me. So all the you know, or I'll be famous, or I'll be able to live on my own. It all ends up being, ultimately, the drive is kind of like your preferences about this real sort of inner, that would be my ideal outcome. That would be my future preference that I would really want. Now that can happen long term, but that can also happen like right now. For example, in a weird way, I'm just driving back in the car with Leo in the back, baby, and I'm playing child songs instead of my music. So in terms of will to power, I'd be thinking, well, just play my music, sack him, because I want power, you know. But no, what I want is peace in the car, so I play his music basically for me, so it stops him crying, so I don't have to hear the crying, right? that's my preferred outcome in that moment. So I bang on all my songs and start, and you know, I have my strategies to basically, and maybe I even throw him a little cheesy snack or something or whatever, and it shuts him up. So basically, oh great, he's quiet. That's worked out well for me. I like these snacks. I like this music. It does me a favor, right? So basically, I'm manipulating things. So ultimately, my next moment works out well. So it's that inner drive to whatever state you want to get to, whether that's long-term or short-term, it's kind of like, you know, it's the will to influence your next moment. And where you don't feel that you're being able to influence things and things are being put on you, that's what becomes really oppressing and feeling annoying. So that could be someone making a comment, it could be the government, it could be someone making you do something you don't want to do. And it's like, no, I want to do what I want to do, you know, and I want it to turn out how I want it to turn out. So what we do then, we'll put loads of spin on it and interpretations, and sometimes we actually fail to admit that we're in, all the other people around us want the same thing. They're up to that as well, which is obviously the basis of arguments as well. You can argue just to have the power to be right and win the argument, not necessarily to learn something new, because it feels like, you know, I don't care if I learn something new. That wasn't my goal. My goal was for you to listen to me, because ultimately you are lower than me, kind of thing. And that's not necessarily always a conscious thing. So Nietzsche was massively into the fact that the body and the urges from the body and the drives and the instincts are way, way more like underpinningly intelligent than the creative mind from the brain.
So that's that pre-rational element, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's pre that, before your brain gets involved.
Yeah, there's no organism on earth that has a brain without a body telling it what to do. So even artificial intelligence needs wires and computers and electric to have the thinking capacity. There's things like amoeba, and there's organisms on the earth that don't have a mind, but they have a body, a perfectly functional organism. So he was like, we've all gone like way too much that the mind actually controls everything, and the body's just there as some sort of dead corpse that anyone could fulfill. So basically, like, in a way, John, you could take your mind out of your body, put it in a glass jar, wire it up, and in a weird, really, really weird way, you'd still be there. Well, it's like, no, not at all, because you're your body mainly, you're not your mind. So what he was saying in Will to Power was that your body naturally, instinctively has these urges, not just to survive, but to dominate, or to dominate your next situations. It's an intelligence in the body. And the danger is to shut down those desires, the bodily desires and things so much that you know that you don't kind of listen to those urges. And he kind of said that consciousness, in a way, that mind, is just an attempt at interpreting an unknown text. You're always post-rationalizing what's just happened, but underneath it, there's a will to power. There's this will that it's not just to biologically survive, which obviously in certain situations that becomes the most pressing thing. But because most of us all the time now, we can survive, and we do survive, you know, and what have you, and life's okay. This will to power, whether that's will to comfort, will to creativity, will to influence, you know, will to be rich, will to be dominant, you know, in sports, the will to oppress others and be on top. There's these natural ways in which you always want to, you know, things to go your way. Yeah, so I find that really interesting, that it's a physical instinct thing rather than just a mind-made, calculated sort of I want to be powerful. It's actually coming from your organism.
Part of that is, as well, Nietzsche said that those basic needs, or that basic drive, it isn't good or bad, it just is. So there wasn't really like a prejudgment to it either, was it? It's just their drives that you've got. They're not good or bad inherently. It's then what your community and the kind of moral views of where you live and where you're brought up, actually, how it bashes off them. But some of the most interesting things with the will to power for me is you hinted to some of it just there, is obviously we've all got different drives and desires. And because, you know, so your drives and desires are going to be totally different to mine, but we've got to be able to, say we lived in the same community, we've got to be able to live together, haven't we?
And
you can multiply that across a community. Everyone's kicking around with all these different drives and desires, very few of which I would imagine are going to overlap. And it's impossible for them to, you know, just because of the sheer amount of people.
Yeah.
And we can't therefore have that total control over the external world to us, can we? Because everyone's butting around with these different, so you're going to get conflict. And as I was reading this and we were just talking about it and listening to stuff on it, it did remind me of the mimetic desire episode we did, where Girard talked about, because of the desires that we have, and the way that we kind of mimic other people, and the way that we acquire our desires, he was very pessimistic in a way, wasn't he? In that he only saw that ending in conflict. act, because everyone is not going to be able to fulfill those inner desires and drives that they've got. So he just thought, it's right, well, ultimately you're going to end up with conflict and chaos, basically. And Nietzsche was probably one of the only philosophers, really, when you look at it, he was like, it doesn't matter. That's, you know, he gets criticized as a theory in a way, because it's very egoistic, isn't it? It's very much about self-interest.
Yeah.
And you doing what's good for you and what your desires are essentially telling you to do to achieve your will to power.
He says, right, without the human being, the human, you know, without the people that acted on those desires instantly and went for it and procreated and did things and moved and took the leap and took the risk, we wouldn't have even got to where we've got to. If it would have been an instinct in us to back off and temper ourselves, we wouldn't have got to where we've got to. But he also praised the fact that we are a civilized world. So he said, you can't just express your will to power over the persecution of others. You can't do it to the point where everybody's, you know, you need people, and there needs to be a balance. But what he then suggested and criticized Catholicism for and religion was that they then took it too far and basically said, no, all your bodily desires and all your, you know, all these things you want, like power and maybe sex and all these other things, and to take it and to have pleasures and to do what you want to do. It was like, no, you can't do that, because, like, it'd just be a nightmare. So what we're going to say, we're going to praise people for being virgins, the Virgin Mary. We're going to praise people for being celibate. We're going to praise people for tempering their desires. So the body, in a way, is a bad thing, but the brain is a higher thing, and they call that the soul. You know, the soul, your soul will last forever, your brain, your mind, who you are. And Nietzsche was like, that's a load of crap. You're first and foremost a bodily organism that's been here for thousands and thousands of years. You've come along and said that this mind thing is what's the most powerful, and that all, and you've tempered all these desires. Now, he understood it to a point. You've got to like adapt and not just go and basically all out war and all out dominance and all everyone just going after. But he said civilization was finding a way anyway. You didn't necessarily need to go to the extreme of basically making everybody a bit scared of their urges, to the will to power, the will to take risks, the will to be the best, the will to better yourself, the will to want things that you really want.
Christianity, though, their promise was, life's rubbish, you're just going to have to endure it, and then you'll get all that good stuff in the afterlife, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it was also controlling, shut down your instincts.
Yeah, but that was the promise they got, that it was like, you'll still get all that, but you've got to live a good life and kind of do what you're told, stay in line, don't you go like chasing all these inner desires and stuff, and you'll get that. And Nietzsche was like, no, that's bollocks, you can't be doing it.
You get a lot of shame and guilt with all those things, because you're like, I really want that, but oh no, I'm a good person because I denied it. And you see it now, don't you? Oh, I didn't have that extra scoop of ice cream at dinner. That means I'm in control. I beat my desires today. I'm disciplined. I'm this. And the bottom line is, you know, Nietzsche said, well, you only live once. Why not have that extra blob of ice cream if you really want it? Now, if you're having too much every day, then you're being stupid, because you're becoming fat with it. And it's not your desire, your will to power, to be fat. If it is, go for it. If not, not. So it's like you've always got to take part and be in touch with what you really want, and is it working? And you wouldn't necessarily take all the ice cream off everybody so they could never have any. You know what I mean? There has to be this civilized type balance where you can, there's abilities to share. But it's literally not, don't go into some weird self-denying, you know, moral high ground, being on your high horse. You know, so he said, like, some of the passions, like, you see this in mafia films, don't you? And you see this in life, that in one situation, something like killing someone to survive, punching someone in the face or something, is like, oh no, that's a horrible human instinct to lash out. But then in another situation where you need protecting because they're going to come and burn your house down or do something to your family, that person's suddenly a hero for going over and smacking someone in the face. He said inherently, not one of the drives is either good or bad. He said it's just appropriate to the circumstance. The same with, you know, procreation, isn't it? And sex and all these things. It's like, in some ways, it's like bonding and useful and private and, you know, and expressive and interesting and innocent. And in other ways, it's considered as like filthy and too much and nasty and horrible, and you're a harlot, or you're a slag, or you're a disgrace. It's always, and that's what he was getting at. He was really trying to take everybody back to the physiological side and saying, not saying you should always act on all the impulses, but let's remember that the organism is a will to power. It's fighting to want things it wants, but we've tempered it with the mind for the good of all, but it's sometimes been taken too far. And I see that a lot in athletes. I see that a lot in people. They sort of play the rational game, and they think about things a lot so that they can take the moral high ground, when deep down they're missing out on what they really could have.
I think that aspect of it, though, is fascinating for me, that just the fact that morality is not innate. But I think if you ask most people, you know, when people say, oh, you get a gut reaction of when something is right or wrong, but it isn't. For Nietzsche, morality is just, it's almost like a total social construction, isn't it? That's what, you're not born with any morality.
No.
You're given it through socialization and the culture that you come up yeah. through. And I find that, you know, fascinating, where the morals that you might have as a guy living in Preston, we've talked about it before, you could do the exact same things on the other side of the world. Mm. And one can be, like you just said, absolutely disgusting and a disgrace. Mm. And the other, you'd be like celebrated as a hero.
Yeah.
Even though the exact same desire and behavior was exhibited.
We see that with how we treat animals and things like that, isn't there? You know, yeah. And you might go, oh, it's hard to, like, that's what Simone de Beauvoir was saying, wasn't it? In the ethics of ambiguity a bit. It's hard to just have a flat line ethics for everything. And where they've tried to do that in the world, it's always created issues and problems. Yeah. Because underneath it is a biological drive to say, don't you tell me what I'm going to need to do in my country or my town with all my history. We will tell you what morality and ethics is. You can go and do yours. We'll do ours over here. Because if we don't kill these animals, we can't eat, right? And if we don't do this, we can't do this. And if we don't, you know, if we don't, I don't know, praise our God with sacrifices, if you went back to the Mayans and things, you'd be like, we're all going to die. So shut up over there with your logic. You know what I mean? He's not saying you should all live like that or like that. He's just actually blowing wide open the fact that there's an instinctive biological drive for will to power. We do it, and we want to do it for us.
The Spartans spring to mind. You mentioned the Mayans. So the Spartans used to, you know, when, say, a baby was born that was physically had issues, they'd just take it out and leave it out to the elements to die.
Yeah.
And like, we'd look at that and go, bloody hell, that's like, how bad is that? That's unbelievable. But for them, it's like, that's just what they did.
That's what I'm saying about him going back to the, you know, it's not like, you know, like natural selection. It's not that kind of biology. It is a bit of that. But I find it on a daily level interesting, because it's like, I'll just to read one of the things he says about will to power. He says, do you want a name for this world? A solution for all its riddles? A light for you? You best concealed, strongest, most intemperate, most midlightly of men. This world is the will to power and nothing besides. And you yourselves are also this will to power and nothing besides. I find it useful to not be cynical about all everybody else and what they're up to, but to actually accept that pretty much everybody is self-biased and wants things to go their way, you know, whether that's just having a cup of tea and a bit of peace, or whether it's being like Elon Musk and being the richest man in the world. Everyone's plotting and wanting little tiny things to go their way. So if you remember that about yourself, that you're up to that a bit, you know, and even though you think you're beyond that, it's quite good for when you imagine other people being up to that. It's not that you get paranoid, you just accept it.
But most people would call that selfish, wouldn't they? So if you said that to my mum, she would say, oh yeah, but you've just been selfish there. You're only bothered about yourself, you're not bothered about others.
Yeah, but being bothered about others could be your will to power. Like Nietzsche says, like, you there's no such thing as altruism in many ways, because ultimately it's to make you feel good. So when you're good to others, it's just so that you can go, oh, I feel better about myself now. I can have that cup of tea because I've done my bit. Well, that's still a will to power. You still wanted to finish the day feeling in yourself, comfortable about yourself, because you've lived to your values. Now, if you weren't allowed that day to go in and help people and express your help and said, no, we're all right today, you leave us alone, you get a bit miffed. But I'm the rescuer. I'm the person that helps. Don't you know? You're not giving me my chance to be helpful. So in some ways, some people are like overly helpful and overly thinking of others. They're the neediest people of all. They're the most dominant. You know that, and that's something Nietzsche suggested as well. That when people thank you for things or be nice to you, they're almost it's their will to power. It's almost their control. Whereas I think when you know what people are up to. And they come apologise. Oh, sorry, I didn't. So you don't need to apologise to me, pal. You're all right. You're not a person to be able to apologise to me. You're just trying to have power on me. And you think, well, that's suspicious. What a weird thing to say. But that's what Nietzsche blew open. He understood how do-gooders and moral high grounds and a lot of these things that people are really up to are really trying to control you in all different ways.
Or at least trying to control your opinion of them.
Yes.
To be aligned with their will to power, isn't it?
Yeah. They now think I am this. So they PR themselves in certain behaviours and ways, but the truth, what they would really want to do and say, they wouldn't dare go near it because it would be a loss in the end game for them. They would really want to go and say this to the boss, and they would really want to say this to one of their friends, and they really want to do these physical acts, and they really want to become this and sack the job, or they really want to say this. But because civilization, all right, you don't go so far, but equally they won't go near it because ultimately the end game is, oh, I might get shamed by everybody. Oh no, that's a bad thing to do. I'd be known as the person who did that forever. And I once put a tweet out that said that, and they'd always remember me as the person that, like we're saying about the Queen at the moment. If you actually come out and people actually said, you know, unfortunately she's died yesterday, someone come out and went, nah, I don't really said what they want to people who like the Queen. You might feel good in the moment, but ultimately you might fear that people would think you were this and that, so you're not going to say it. Now, comedians will get to the point a lot, but they can hide behind. Ricky Gervais is a classic. He says a lot of things he wants to say, but he goes, it's just a joke. Just a joke. Just can't you take a joke? But a lot of comedians, that's what Nietzsche said as well, they get to the truth and we can kind of accept it a bit. And when you go and see a comedian, it's very cathartic because you'll see a lot of audiences watching Mickey Flanagan or Ricky Gervais or certain Frankie Boyle, and they actually say things others can't say that you want to say and feel. And you're in the audience cringing at yourself or nodding in approval or laughing at yourself because you can't believe that they've said it and that's what you want to say. So when Ricky Gervais blew open the Academy Awards in his speech, when he goes in, he goes,
if you do win an award tonight, don't use it as a platform to make a political speech, right? You're in no position to lecture the public about anything. You know nothing about the real world. Most of you spent less time in school than Greta Thunberg. So, if you win, right, come up, accept your little award, thank your agent and your God, and
piss off, right? And Tom Hanks is in the crowd going, oh my God, that's terrible. You know what I mean? He's blowing, that's a Nietzsche thing, he's blowing open the bullshit.
But this is what I like about that moral. So the collective, that's what defines the morals. So,
yeah.
And for those morals to be imposed, so for that to work, there has to be, which is what Nietzsche was getting at, that feeling that comes has to be suppressed by a thought. So
yeah.
You get that drive first, and what you really want to say, what you really want to do.
Yeah.
But for the moral framework to work,
yeah.
You then have to supersede that with a thought that goes, hang on, if I say that, I'm going to get ostracized and they're never going to speak to me again, or I might lose my job, or I'm going to get blacklisted. That's what upholds the moral framework of a culture or a community, isn't it? It's not any like inner thing that says what you said was bad. Definitively, it's the moral standards of the community.
Well, it's like Nick Kyrgios in the tennis. If you had 100 players like him, who basically he's just like, I'll be who I want to be and say what I want to say, you know, to a point beyond what we normally expect, you know, all the bullshit and all the things people actually say, like all the pundits in sports and all the, you know. So he smashed his rackets to pieces, didn't he, when he lost? Oh, terrible, you know. Now obviously that's not sustainable, but who doesn't feel like doing that now and again, you know, smashing a golf club, walking off, or because your desires haven't been met, your will to power to win that match, the truth is you didn't get it and you're just pissed off, you know, and you're disappointed. So a lot of people do now, this is Nietzsche again, he said they post rationalize. guys and come up with an instant story why it's okay to lose and why this and that. But the truth is that they didn't do the situation right, and that's what they really, you know, and that's what they could really learn from. They didn't take the moment. They didn't dominate. They didn't go and get it. They weren't in the bodies. They started rationalizing about it. You would expect more of an honesty from people, but they don't. They quickly rationalize it, temper their actual desires and what they wanted. And then everybody around goes, oh, it don't matter. You played really well. It doesn't matter. You know, don't be too upset. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, a cat type thing. But they say that in a way of soothing. Now, Nietzsche would say, obviously, that's his phrase, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Nietzsche would say that in more of a move on quickly, get back on your horse, take action and take your power. Don't sulk about it, be angry about it or whatever, but fix it.
But I think he would also say as well that's kind of the point. It's putting yourself in those risky positions where you might lose or you might get defeated or you might, you know, come a cropper. That's part of that rich life for Nietzsche, isn't it? It's like, pursue it, get after life. Like we talked about in the Camel and the Child episode, he saw those people as like the heroes, didn't he? They're getting after it and they're doing what they need to do to meet their kind of desire, become who they can truly become.
Yeah.
Fulfill the potential.
Admit it.
It's that analogy of the person in the, I can't remember the phrase, is a quote, isn't it? It's the person in the fight, in the kind of stadium in there, in the middle of it, not the person on the outside commenting on them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, it links into book, really good book that, well, say a book, Adler, Alfred Adler took on Nietzsche's stuff. In psychology, like, you know, less philosopher, and in his psychology, it was all about taking Nietzsche's ideas to, some of it was not having an inferiority complex, you know, and not, but equally trying not to have a superiority complex. So a book came out that you can popularly get. It's full of Adler's stuff, one of the psychologists from the Vienna School of Psychology from the mid-20th century, was The Courage to be Disliked. And it was like, the message is, if you're going to take power, if you're going to be the one that takes things you want, you are just going to piss people off. Now, don't do it to the absolute detriment of causing everyone's endless suffering and too much suffering. Take what you want and admit it, and don't worry if people don't like you for it. So I remember Laura, when she played, used to play Nicole David, who was a dominant squash player in the world at the time, and everybody liked her, and she was really nice, from Malaysia, very, very polite, and she had this persona of being really nice, but she won everything. And she was a real feisty warrior competitor, and she keep wanting to win. It was almost like you can't be nasty to her because she's so nice. Like, you couldn't go up to Roger Federer and give him a mouthful because everyone would think you were nasty. Or like Kyrgios has done to some of the players, you know, he's fronted them out and they go, oh, it's disrespect. Oh, he's such a nice person. Well, you know, I had to get it to a point where Laura said, at the end of the day, Laura, you want to win this match, right? She's just a girl, you're a girl. Go and get in her face, tell her, you know, tell her if she moans about anything, tell her what you're doing, what you're on about. And I remember Laura getting in her face, and everybody around was like, oh my God, oh my God. And from that point on, Laura had a bit of a reputation of being what's been called the ice queen. In other words, like solid and hard. So she wasn't liked by everybody. They soon started to like her when she won everything, you know, but at the time, it was like, oh, she's this and she's that. But it's because she was actually, in a way, admitting she really, really wanted to win more than anything. And I think a lot of other, in sport, that, again, that's where Nietzsche said sport or creative activities can be good. Because rather than having to fulfill the will to power of dominance, say, dominating other people, being a bit better than them, rather than doing that by going and killing the tribe, you know, like cowboys and Indians or whatever, and land, do it through sport. Let those desires, let that will to power come out in sport. So just admit it, go for it. And I think you see that, don't you, in MMA and boxing, and you see in some sports that it's like, no, the only reason I'm here is for that belt.
That Tyson Fury video the other day, that was the epitome of that, wasn't it?
There's only one man in the heavyweight division, and you're looking at him. I'm the Dauntless in the Waters. I've knocked out the biggest puncher in boxing history. I've beat the longest reigning champion in history. I am the man, and I can't be beat. That's why I'm unbeaten in I don't know how many years. I've lost count.
Yeah, that's it. So you can do it more in those sports naturally because it's expected, and you're not you're not a shun. But even Tyson Fury takes it to the next level. And then Conor McGregor did that, didn't he? But then I think people try to copy it, you know, and they think it's the thing. So it's got to have a bit of a belief and a genuine authenticity to it. And you've got to be able to obviously back it up. But the point is, have the courage to be disliked. Don't worry if people think you're out there or you're not conforming or you're this and that. You're going to get, you should, you know, I when I've worked with players, you know, sometimes I've said to them, you know, they want to make a breakthrough. And I'm like, how come everybody loves you? I can't find three people that think you're an idiot. You should be pissing people off at some point. Some people must be annoyed at you, and they're just like, oh, God's sake, what an idiot. It's just this, just that. You should kind of be dividing opinion a little bit, because you're taking something from them and they fear you. They should feel that you're coming at them and you're going to take what they've got. So they're feeling you rise up. And that's what happens in workplaces, isn't it? You know, when you see young protagonists come in and they're quite this and quite that, and you sense that they're going to, you know, their mission is to get climb the ladder. So you try all your tactics to put them down and hold them back. You might even befriend them. You might even pretend you're helping them. You might go to them and say some clever comments, or, you know what I mean? There's all a million tactics at the end of the day where you're trying to like keep your power over them, because you know they're coming and they're going to go past you. So, you know, so you think, oh, I'm going to lose this battle. So what I'll do, I'll just be the, it's inevitable. So I'll be the consistent friend that was always there. So when they do get to the top, they'll remember me. So you play a game without really knowing it, because if your will to power is that I don't want them to shaft me one day, and it's better for me if I get on with them and do this. When you leave work, you can then have a pop at people, because it's unlikely, you can burn that bridge, because it's unlikely you're going to go back. But you don't burn it down too publicly. You can just do it in a certain level that makes you feel puffed up and that you've made the right decision. And that's fine. That's Nietzsche would say. That's being more honest.
But I think that if people were to explicitly explain that that's what they do, or admit that that's what they do, because I agree, I think everyone's doing that 24/7.
Yeah.
And it is unconscious. You know, those drives are unconscious, but I still think people are maybe unaware of some of those tactical, you know, quite Machiavellian things, you know, in workplaces. Yeah. And it's like, you can be someone's best mate when you're basically plotting to take them down, ultimately.
Yeah.
Now, you might know that deep down, but if you were to actually admit it, and not even to someone, I'll just admit it to yourself. Mm. I don't think it's a particularly nice thought to have, is it? That,
no.
Hell yeah, I'm like, you know, I would properly screw some people over here.
Yeah.
For even me to get a promotion, off for them to get knocked down a peg or two. Back to the schadenfreude again, isn't it? How that, you know, that we take pleasure in other people.
Yeah. If it came down to the two of us, I'd do this. And that's the thing. I think that knowing that about yourself, and knowing that you're not holier than thou, or you're biased and you have motivated reasoning for many of the choices and things you're up to, even if you are very nice and altruistic, there are obviously some desires that are more sociable and accepted based on the center of the cultures, you know, accepted what's good and what's bad. So you can't, and you do, there are, I'm sure there are some natural things that are just better. You know, there is sometimes pure love, and there is just bonding and help, and you don't think about it too much. But
is that again why we love animals so much though? Because they, as far as we can tell, they don't have that level of yeah, plotting. So you know, a dog's love, it's as pure as it gets, isn't it? There's none of that calculation or like plotting. Well, if I do this and then I do that. I mean, they might be thinking, well, I know if I do this, he'll give me a treat.
Yeah.
Or he'll give me a
Get
biscuit.
Me out for a walk.
Yeah, there's that element where, but that's just conditioned behavior, isn't
yeah,
it? But I don't think at any point they're plotting, right, if I do this and then blah, blah, it's just not in them. And I think maybe that's why it gives you a breather from being in social settings where, you know, we do subconsciously, you know, all this plotting is going on, and it's a battle to basically, yeah, tread water, isn't it? Hold your own amongst. Whereas a dog, you just don't have it.
Well, that's it. I get it. Yeah. And animals, they have that innocence then, don't they? And maybe babies have that. So they have the innocence. They're just like in the world, and the drives are there. So we, because it's innocent, we don't mind it when them drives are there. We go, oh, look at it. You know, oh, the little stubborn little thing, look. It wants its own way. But because we know it's a genuine thing and it's not plot. I think I was watching Hypernormalization again, Adam Curtis, the other week, and there was that scene in it where the guy built the computer based on Carl Rogers' therapy, where he basically just repeats back what the person who's got the problem says. So they go, my husband hates me. And the computer went, "You just made a program. Your husband hates you, does he?" And she'd go, "Yes, my husband hates me." And he goes, "Oh, your husband hates you. Why do you think that might be?" And there's just these neutral, bog-standard questions that force her back in on herself to like unload what she thinks. And the guy who built the computer couldn't believe it. These people were spending ages and hours on this computer, getting totally loads of therapy off it. And even asked the researchers to leave the room, you know, because just leave me alone with this computer. They give it a name, you know, whatever. Leave me alone with Alice or Brian, whatever they called it. And basically, when they asked the ladies, like, who were in therapy, like, at the time, I don't know if they did it with males, I don't know, but this particular ladies that they did at this group, he went, "Well, firstly, it didn't want anything from me. It didn't presume to know what I was feeling. And I also know that they didn't want to get me in bed." Do you know what I mean? And you're watching it going, "What are they on about?" But when we talk about this, like what you've just said, it's hard to find another human that isn't up to something. Because it's natural. Because it's a natural will to power. Because, why are they being nice to me? Is it conditioning? Because they want to feel better themselves? They're being nice to me because they want something. They don't know me. Why are they being nice to me? Are they being nice to me because they think we live in a bad world and they're just trying to create an illusion of community? So that's what you kind of know. People are up to things. But because you don't think of it that way a lot, you just kind of have to go along with the acts. You just go along and don't think about it too much in a way. But Nietzsche, this is why Nietzsche, as they said, "I am dynamite," didn't he? That was his thing, "I am dynamite." He's literally blowing things up. You know, he's going, "That nice conversation you've had for 30 years with your neighbour about that and that, it's only because you've wanted some safety off each other. It's not because you actually like each other. It's only because you don't want her to go down the road and slag you off, which means that you're more safe because if someone burgles your house, they'll all come and help you. It's nothing to do with you actually like the lady." And he blows it up. And that's why, you know, I am no philosopher, he said. "I am dynamite." I don't even see it as cynical. He backs it up with, and then he goes to all the pre-Socratics and pre-rational and gives you loads of examples of pre-rational societies and said they function pretty well and they function a lot more truer than what, since we've become rational and the mind is king, that it's the mind that's constantly playing these games. And okay, you need the mind. It's been produced by the brain. The bodily organism has produced the mind. But the mind's a very, very, very small servant. The real intelligence, the real knowing what you need and what a life is in your bodily systems.
Where do you see Buddhism and things like meditation and that kind of, that's got very trendy and well, it's been for years, but particularly recent years, I think just because of the way society is making people feel, you know, it's quite stressful. A lot of people are on edge. So things like meditation are very popular. Where do you see that fitting in with this? So that's obviously trying to quieten your mind to some extent.
Yeah.
Which is what you're saying people should do and tune more into those inner feelings and desires. But is that a good thing? Another part of Buddhism and meditation, it's taking the ego out of it, isn't it? So it's trying to forget that egocentric aspect, which is what Nietzsche is going, no, you need to embrace that. That's what we're all about. Just go for it. Do it, go after it.
Yeah, it's funny because he'd say, like, there's a mix between, let's remember you are a physical organism. Your physical organism, right, is growing your hair. It's doing 1,000 things already this morning for you that you've not asked it to do, right? Kidneys, whatever, liver, heart, lungs, breathing, repair, digestion, sleep. You know what I mean? You know a lot about that with your cellular energy stuff you do. And you know, so he was massive as well into that we don't know this. That's why he said with civilization, basically, and everything is trying to read an unknown text. Consciousness is attempting to interpret an unknown text. We've no idea what the body's up to. And nutrition and all these other things are affecting it in way more ways than what your mind is, right, in the first place, at the cellular level and the bodily intelligence level. Disease, fighting, blah, 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 and all these things. So that was one thing he also agreed. So then he'd say, okay, so all these bodily functions and all these instincts and these drives that have come through the generations in your DNA that have made your body you, you are your body, you are not your mind, right? Your mind has been created by your body and it's there. So when he talks about the ego, it kind of wouldn't give it as much importance. He'd say, why are you all obsessing about the ego as this big thing? Just, it's not that important. And in a way, what Nietzsche says a bit like, people then want to detach from the world, because if you can detach from the world, something I picked up on Stephen West's podcast, he said it great, that if you can get to such a Buddhist state, heightened state, where he says you know, your youngest child could die in front of you and you wouldn't care.
The Stoics and that kind of philosophy.
You're just so detached, you're so big picture, you're so removed from your ego, you wouldn't care. But on the flip side, you wouldn't get that absolute unbelievable buzz when they smile at you for the first time, or, you know, the up and the down. So yeah, okay, you might be there trying to avoid the ego drive and detach yourself so much, but you're missing out on life. And I actually read a book recently by a guy who'd been a forest monk called I May Be Wrong. And he talked a lot about how he went down that path for 20 years living in Malaysia and all these places as a forest monk and silence and shut. And it didn't really work. He said, ultimately, I came back to society and my drives were still driving me forward. I did learn a few things, that the mind is often wrong. But what you got from it was, there's no escape from your body. Your body and your drives are always there. You can detach as much as you want. And why would you want to detach anyway? Why wouldn't you want to follow? Why wouldn't you want highs and lows? Pain's inevitable in the world. Why Nietzsche said, well, just you know, it's part of life. You just have to go for it. You get your ups, you get your downs. Why do you want this constant sheltered? And I think that's what goes on with people a lot. I think that they're not used to the suffering moments too much, or the pain. So they're like, oh, flipping heck, I should be in constant bliss. And almost trying to get to this mediocre happy state all the time, rather than, which, you know, understandable because it's comfortable, rather than kind of taking risks and things going right and things going wrong. And that's what I always find with sport. I always find professional sport and playing sport hard. Like golf, we play golf, you know, and it's absolutely absurd, but we make a lot of meaning out of it. And if we play well, we're buzzing. And if we play rubbish, we're gutted.
Yeah, there was some absurdity the other day when we played, wasn't there?
Yeah, you're like, oh, bloody, I can't believe it. And you're honest. You're being honest with yourself. I'm really pissed off. Because sport gives you the chance to reconnect with those desires from your body. You feel absolutely fantastic when you nail something at sport. A footy shot, a golf shot, throw a dart, a snooker pot, a punch, a javelin throw, dance, you know, a catch. You just feel like, poof, that feeling. Yeah, I want more of that. Yeah, I want more of that. And then when you don't get it, you're like a baby. Oh, frick, rub it. And you feel embarrassed. And so, again, you know, sport, I find actually playing sport, not talking about sport and theorizing about sport, but in it, playing it, that really does reveal, you know, you're the real, like, the fact that you're a desire machine, you know. And I think there's a lot of things in sports psychology where they try and temper you and keep you calm and all that. And sometimes I think, well, I don't know, go the other way. Go the other way, get emotional. You know, what's wrong with being a bit of a baby when you lose? You wanted to win. We're all different personalities, but you know what I mean? It's not all, oh, don't worry. You shouldn't be ashamed. It's only a game. It's a bit like, stop making it mediocre. Have the up and have the down.
I think sport is the perfect, I don't know if analogy is even the right word, but sport is a great mechanism to see a lot of what Nietzsche was talking about through, because it's so emotional and because it's so embodied and just everything about it, it really brings this stuff to light, doesn't it? Again, with the analogy he uses, which we talked about in the camel episode, is that climbing a mountain, isn't it? You know, the people who get to the top of the mountain are the ones who get the best views. The people he called it like the last man of the herd, didn't he? So if you just live a mediocre life, you don't take any risks. Mm. You just kind of get by. It's like you alluded to it, you run away from pain.
Yeah.
Anything that looks a bit risky, or you're like, I'm not sure how that might go, and you run away from it. Like that's, you're never gonna grow that way. You're never gonna realise your potential if you just avoid all that stuff. You've got to get up the mountain and risk it.
We talked last episode, didn't we, about the psychologically rich life.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So you sat at home, you're flicking through Netflix and you're like, I'm just gonna watch that. or you stretch yourself, right? And you go, no, I'm going to watch, I'm going to get into this new thing, or something a bit deeper, or I'm going to turn the telly off and, you know, read a book or go outside and do something that needs, you know, that's going to stretch me. It's whatever. You can go for that middle range, comfy, stay on your phone. You know, that blobby life when you know you're being a bit blobby, like, you know, and it's comfy, like you're just there, which is fine because that obviously might be what you need at that moment. But again, Nietzsche would be like, no, the organism, the true desires, it wants to get moving, it wants to build, you want to be doing things and creating, and you want to make your situation better. He doesn't believe that the physical body wants to just be a blob. It might want to relax and chill so that it can bring some energy later. It knows it needs a good sleep because it's going to go bang, or it has a nap and rests because it needs to hunt, you know, and dominate in the next 20, you know, whatever it wants to look well. But you're not just going in this constant, like, mediocreness.
I think that brings us full circle to what I asked you at the start. Mm. So when I said, what's more powerful for you, the will to live or your will to power? Well, everyone, you know, again, we mention this every episode, you know, clearly everyone's got different experiences and life experiences, but pretty much everyone that we kind of kick about with a note, they're not, you know, they don't need to go out and hunt to eat. They've got food, they've got a roof over their head. You know, the classic Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that's kind of taken care of for pretty much most people these days.
Yeah.
So your will to live, it's almost like it's gone, isn't it? Because you're never going to be chased down the street by a lion or a rival tribe or anything. If you, you know, no one's going to come and crack you over the head for you.
not where we live at the moment, but in obviously many parts of the world there would be. But yeah,
obviously, yeah. So we're talking very, you know, from a privileged, you know, cultural background that we have and everything. Yeah. But you know, I'm imagining the type of people that listen to this podcast. Put it that way. I don't think any of them are kind of really struggling for that will to live at that level, perhaps. Right. So you're right. It's like, well, once you've got that, what do? You just sit there and go, well, I'm living, I'm happy, I've got no risks. Why would I want more than this? My will to live is fulfilled. That does me, and I'll just be a blob until I turn 80, and then that's me done. Most people do have, because like Nietzsche said, you have got these inner drives, whether you like it or not. They're basically biological. Mm. They're innate. You've got them. So it is, I think people have a choice, don't they? You have got a choice whether you pursue your will to power or not.
I average people go, I kind of always have a project on, or people call me enthusiastic about things and pretty upbeat and what have you. And I think that's because of the will to power. I actually want to be, I want this, and I want people to think that. And I want, now I don't want to then go out and put that power on people. I don't want to control people, but it's more for my myself, kind of, yeah, I'm growing all the time. I'm doing things I didn't think I could do, and things are happening. And I'm also getting stronger at being more like saying, I'm getting older and, you know, but that's bringing me more autonomy, if you know what I mean. And then if I do something a bit more nicer, and I do relax, and I do, you know, might do things I might not really want to do, I actually am like, no, that isn't manipulative. I'm going to do that because it'll make me grow. That's out of my comfort zone a bit. You know, I know I don't normally go there and spend the night with those people and do this. And I know I said I'd never be the type of person who, you know, do that. But no, I'm going to do it because I'm going to do it on my terms. But I'm still going to do it. I'm not doing it because I feel guilty or ashamed or I feel, you know, better had, because, you know, these are the things you should do. And I think people know where they stand with me because of that, and a little bit more straight down the line. But still, you know, still as you'd still be as manipulative as the next person, not on a necessarily conscious level, but you're always trying to manipulate situations so that you come across favorably, and you're this and you're that, and you don't tell constant whole truths and all things. But I think to finish for me, like, the bottom line is, you know, when people are listening to this, they go, right, okay, so what can I do tomorrow then? What can I actually do with this will to power thing? And I think from Nietzsche's perspective, it'd be more like tune into your body a bit more, you know, really, really tune into your body, and remember that you're not your mind all the time, that you actually are a living bodily organism, and try and feel what you want to do, you know, and do a few more things. I think stand up for yourself more. Take, you know, stand up for yourself. Like, be a bit more honest with what you really want to say, and don't think that, you know, don't be worried about being disliked for that. And again, that doesn't mean that brutally truthful with everybody to the point of it being, you know, like Larry David in.
I can't remember who said it, but there's a quote I've always liked, and it's like, the only man who is truly free is the man who can turn down an invitation to dinner without giving an excuse. And I've always liked that, just that, yeah, I'm not doing that. And you don't have to feel like you need to justify it, or, you know. Whereas a lot of the time you feel like you have to give a reason, don't you?
That's a brilliant point. You don't have to give excuses and make up lies. Don't lie, you know, like Peterson said, I like that one, but at least don't lie. Tell the truth, or at least don't lie. So don't say, well, to be honest, the truth really is you're boring I'd rather sit at home by myself watching the rainfall and not have to put up with you lot, to be honest, on Thursday. Might change my mind next week, but that's how I feel. You're not going to say that, but at least just go, no, I'm not coming, I don't want to come. There's nothing wrong with saying that. But people go, oh, no, what it is, I've got, you know, I've had a, and they cook up a storm.
Could do, I just need to check this, and I might.
Check me diary, I'll get back to you. You know, every Christmas, isn't it, that, you know, oh, that's the best at Christmas, I love it. Yeah, we'll catch up between Christmas and New Year. That's the classic way of saying, I don't want to be in your company, mate.
I'm never going to speak to you again.
Yeah, we'll catch, because you know everyone's knackered after Christmas. Nothing happens. Yeah, no, we will. Christmas and New Year. Yeah, we definitely will. Yeah, you're definitely, mate. Yeah, bye, mate. And every Christmas too, we'll get in touch more this year. And that's fine. I'd rather people just say, you know, I won't be in touch. I'll see you next Christmas. I can't be the house for you. I like seeing you once a year. You really like, you're always in my heart, mate, to be honest. But in terms of real mates, I've got loads of mates. I don't need to keep seeing you. You know, you say that, you're Larry David, aren't you? You're weird. But why is that popular? Why does that make people laugh and cringe? Because it's so close to the truth, and that's the dynamite bit of Nietzsche. So we'd sort of say move towards that a bit more. And the last thing I'd say is just like walk tall a bit more. Walk tall, get your chest out, you know, be who you want, be in your body a bit, get your physiology up, you know. I'd say that he'd say shoulders back and, you know, feel good in your body and feel attractive. And don't feel shady about yourself or too ashamed. Don't let your mind tell you that you're sneaky or... Because you have these desires, you're a bit of a fraud and you're not being true. Just, you know, you don't have to act them all out, but just be a bit more comfortable being what your body wants a bit more. And also, don't deny other people's around you. You know, if they say something, they're straight with you and honest, don't go away going, oh my God, can you believe what they said? Oh. Just think about why your reaction's that way when all that they've done is said their truth. You know, don't perpetuate it with gossip and shock and, oh, because that just makes you, all you're trying to do there is put yourself in a morally high position. You'd be better off just accepting it and then doing something for yourself.
I agree with all of those points. And that's why, especially on the course that we do, that's why bioenergetics for me is the final workshop, the final theme that we get into, because it genuinely does, it all comes full circle. Your thoughts are only going to be as good as your biology. And that's, yeah. I think Nietzsche, which is surprising given that he had a hell of a lot of bad health, let's be honest. He didn't live the best life, you know, physically, did he? Ultimately. But I think he was onto something. He knew he tapped into that bioenergetic cellular metabolism thing. And he knew that that was so influential on everything that goes on up top. But I think maybe modern day we've switched it. There's too much psychology perhaps, isn't there? Yeah. Coming, and this is coming from people who love psychology and philosophy and talking about rationalizing stuff. But I think we've flipped it. There's too much of that. And we're just forgetting the underlying biology that's going on that these drives come from.
Well, I think therefore I am from Descartes. You know, it just highlighted how important the brain was. Like your body, it's not, I am here, so I am. It's like, no, you know, your body's nothing. It's just like a corpse, like anyone. Without the soul and the mind, it's just useless. And it's like, that's not right. It's more, it's not dual. It's one, more one. If anything, it's more body.
I desire, therefore I am.
And you know that with hangovers, you know, I've thought, why can't I do hangovers and all this? And it isn't shame or guilt or, oh, I shouldn't have gone out. I'm not bothered about that. literally physically wrecked at the cellular level, and I can't feel good. So that's my body. So my body's saying to me, can't do that all the time. But then my desire is, yeah, but I love having a drink, and I like the social bit, and you know, the laughing and that. So I go and do it to the point enough where it's not going to send my whole life into pieces. So there is a compromise, but you've got to listen and tune into your body. You know, it's funny, I was saying to a player yesterday with squash, I can just go on a squash court now and just, my mind's going, oh, I can't play. I'm walking woody and I'm, oh, I can't get in that corner and run to that corner and play a rally. Shit. When I get to the courts and I warm up, my body just does it. It's like, I'll do it. It loves it. But that's where I can use my mind a bit and go, just watch it. Because even though your body would go for it, you could have an heart attack because you're not no spring chicken anymore. Because it remembers all the nice feelings of the movements and the rhythms. It would just keep me going. So that's where your mind can come in. And your mind isn't an evil thing. It's a servant, and it's a bloody useful, brilliant, rational servant. It's the best thing ever. I'd miles rather be that than an animal, you know. But it ain't, words like mindset, growth mindset, positive cycle. Our language overplays the role of the mind way too much. You know, we're an organism, we're a physical organism first and foremost, you know, and we shut off that bodily intelligence at our peril, I reckon.